Thanks for listening to The Rest Is Politics. Sign up to The Rest Is Politics Plus to enjoy ad-free listening, receive a weekly newsletter, join our members' chat room, and gain early access to live show tickets. Just go to therestispolitics.com. That's therestispolitics.com.
Welcome to The Rest Is Politics Question Time with me, Rory Stewart.
And me, Alistair Campbell.
Very good. Here we are. What question appealed to you most this week?
Well, there's one that says, for Rory, Paul Grindley, how can civil servants become politically active? Now, you've been a civil servant and a politician. And he says, after reading Alistair's most recent book, I'm interested in becoming more involved in politics. However, he goes on, as a civil servant, there are limits to what I can get involved in. Does Rory have any advice for active civil servants who want to get politically active?
Oh, I'm afraid if
you worried about that.
I'm afraid if you want to get really politically active, you should leave the civil service and either become a, you know, join a party, become a special advisor, stand for election. I think it's really important that our civil service is independent profession. We were just talking yesterday in relation to Bangladesh that one of the great tragedies is the way in which Bangladesh never managed from the 70s onwards to create a fully professional, independent, non-political civil service. It's one of the great crowns and, you know, crown jewels of Britain.
Yeah. I mean, I had an email the other day from not Paul, another civil servant, who said that he was thinking of becoming a candidate.
Very good.
But that means to become a candidate, you have to put your name out there.
Yeah.
So if you have a very, very, very strict view as you do, it means you're further cutting the gene pool. Because he was saying that if he goes for it and doesn't get it, it damages his career. If he goes for it and gets it, his career as a civil servant's over anyway. Because I don't think you can be a member of a political party.
You can, yeah. Although I wasn't, and many civil servants don't join political parties.
For that reason. Yeah. For that reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a tricky one. It's a tricky one. Anyway, Paul, just, you know, work away, wheedle away.
I mean, civil servants are amazing because obviously they have, you know, like all of us, very strong political views. But generally speaking, they are incredibly professional.
I saw something this week that did slightly alarm me and I think would not have happened under any previous government. It was the Treasury put out one of those sort of tax calculator things that was absolutely, to my mind, overtly party political. And I saw that the Labour Party have actually written to Simon Case about it, I think, the Cabinet Secretary. I think the lines are already blurring too much.
Well, one of the problems is that because politicians get impatient with being blocked by civil servants, there's been a tendency to bring in civil servants who seem to be more on the government side and more predicated, and younger civil servants, people like Simon Case, who's the head of the civil service, but is much younger, much less experienced than his predecessors. And I guess one of the questions for a Keir Starmer administration is, will they have the confidence to go back to having more senior people who can be quite awkward, who can often refuse to do what the politicians
but
want them
to do? Probably makes for better government.
But makes a better government. Yeah.
By the way, when I was up in Scotland, Stephen Munro, regular listener on the Coroner Ferry, he said, you in particular, but also me, that we too often talk about a Labour government as though it's already a done deal.
Yeah.
Which you did there when there's a Labour government.
Yeah. I assume it's a done deal.
Do you really?
Yeah. I also think
see, I'm also sort of
maybe a bit specialist.
Did you assume Brexit was going to happen?
I had an argument with a guy who was the former Attorney General of Ireland and then the head of Goldman Sachs at one of these horrible trilateral commission meetings in Rome, you know, where all the great European
aristocracy
were there. So it was Count Herman von Rompuy and Mario Monti and all these people bang on. And he said to me, what's going to happen? And I said, it's going to be 52-48 for Brexit. Wrote it on a bit of paper, which he kept. And he produced it for me.
How long before?
About 3 months before,
okay,
probably.
Okay, pretty good.
But I was largely doing it to wind him up. I'm not sure I would have put a lot of money on it.
The bookies.
Yeah. Okay, question for you. Malcolm Stark, apart from instances involving legal constraints, when is it permissible for ministers and other politicians to respond with, I haven't seen, read, heard of this document, stroke claim, stroke statement? Do you think that's a reasonable response if a minister went out and did that in your day?
I don't think it's great. I think it's permissible if something is sprung upon you. I guess what that question stems from is that Rishi Sunak was interviewed by Laura Koonsberg on the BBC, and she was asking him about documents which she said she'd seen, in which he expressed his reservations as Chancellor about the Rwanda scheme. And she pressed him quite hard on him. I saw the clips on social media. And he kept saying, I haven't seen the documents. He didn't answer the question about whether he'd expressed reservations. So I think that is unacceptable, because actually he's only answering the part of the question about the document as opposed to his
view. Just help me, because I mean, putting myself in his position, I can see why it might be quite awkward if when you were Chancellor, you thought and probably maybe continued to think the Rwandan scheme was a bit dodgy, and then as Prime Minister, you're getting behind it. What's the best way of answering that kind of question, imagining he actually had been a bit against the Rwanda scheme when he was Chancellor and now getting behind it?
He sort of got there in the end. Look, my job as Chancellor is to analyse policy from every which way, but especially the financial implications and what discussions took place led to the policy that we now have.
Right.
Now, he kind of said that, but he kept making this point, I haven't seen the documents you're talking about. And it was similarly, I don't know if you've seen that mashup, I believe they're called, of his evidence to the COVID inquiry. Somebody has put together all the moments in which he says, I don't recall, I can't recall, I can't remember, I don't recall, I don't have an exact recollection. I think once you give the impression that you're actually trying to stall or hide behind it, I think it becomes very unconvincing. But it can be a tactic. It's just a straightforward tactic.
John Sunat, how will you keep yourself safe from AI-generated misinformation during the elections?
Well, I don't think anybody can honestly answer that question with any great knowledge. I saw another extraordinary, well, it wasn't that extraordinary yesterday. There was one of Joe Biden. He had Kamala Harris at his one side and another woman at the other side. And he did this response to a question. And he basically said, well, my answer, I want to answer that in one word. And then he just said this kind of gibberish.
Right.
Now, I watched that and said, that is not real.
Yep.
And you get a feel.
And that was on X.
Yeah.
And had someone put a comment saying this isn't real into the post? Because that's one of the things they're relying
on. They hadn't at the time I saw it. But the comments below it were, including Elon Musk.
Right.
Including Elon Musk with a comment or a question mark or a blimey kind of thing. So I don't know how we're going to handle this. I also saw one of your friend King Charles doing stand-up comedy. Have you seen that one?
No.
I think it's
very, very worrying for everybody. I think it's worrying for our constitutional monarchy. I think it's really, I mean, one of the questions is how quickly you can get on top of these things. So if I were in government, I would be setting up a very, very efficient rapid rebuttal unit. You almost can't prevent somebody loading something fake onto X, but you've got to move within minutes to get. So what I think you need a protocol where, let's say you're Keir Starmer, you're the new prime minister, some crazy stuff goes on. You need a protocol where you can immediately get the leader of the opposition, the key newspapers to come out immediately and say, this is false, and have an agreement that you'll do that together.
Don't you think that some of these newspapers will be wanting things that they might deep down know aren't real, actually to turn them into stories?
Could you try to build that trust? Because remember, it was quite good when there was that fake story about Keir Starmer shouting at someone for dropping his iPad. There was a very, very rapid rebuttal from Tory ministers who came out immediately and said this is... So clearly there'd been some kind of agreement.
But another one I saw last week was a very sort of slick-looking video and it was Keir Starmer explaining why he's going to have to put taxes up.
And was it shot as though it had been caught in an iPhone?
No, it was quite slick. It was quite slick.
And it was completely fake.
Well, I've certainly never heard him say that. Right. And what I think that will do, that will just do the rounds on WhatsApp groups. And, you know, we were talking about...
So it needn't go on X. A lot of this is spread through WhatsApp.
And no, but also your idea that they come together and say, right, we're all going to come out and rebut this stuff presupposes that people are going to be looking out for the rebuttal. They won't necessarily see the places where it's being rebutted.
The context thing on X is very tough, isn't it?
If I were Rishi Sunak, I would be a little bit alarmed about how many of his tweets at the moment are being contextualised. I don't know whether he's doing them himself or whether he sees them, but an awful lot of them
are being contextualized.
Yeah, there was one the other day that said, this is not true.
Well, I guess that will become part of the normal political machine.
Both parties will start
employing contextualizing people.
Exactly. But then what that does is it just sort of feeds this narrative that they're all a bunch of liars and you can't believe a word they say. So I think the most important thing is that the parties just find better ways of communicating what they are actually saying and doing. And in America, I mean, I can't even begin to imagine what the Republicans in particular. Did you see, by the way, this wasn't fake, God Made Trump, the video?
No.
I don't think we should put it in the newsletter, but it was this unbelievable film made by some of these evangelicals.
About how God made Trump.
God made Trump.
So yeah. I know we're often accused of podultry, but it's quite a niche podcast done by Tristram Harris, who does a lot on AI. where he's interviewed two people specifically about AI and elections. It's quite a serious listen. Takes quite a long time.
What are you saying? We're not.
No. But
so we're trivial.
I'm saying
we're not important. We're pointless.
I'm not saying any of that. I'm trying to explain that it may not necessarily be the thing that everybody, top of everyone's list. But if you want a bit of a listen, we'll put a link in.
And what conclusions?
Well, one of the things that they're interested in is this question around whether you can create sort of QAnon-style conspiracies. So obviously QAnon, this US conspiracy where, you know, Hillary Clinton's involved in child sex rings, this kind of stuff, that AI is very, very good at doing that kind of stuff. But their big point, and I think this is a central point, is that we are in a critical year, which is the gap between when the US, UK and others have worked out what the regulation is and the gap before the regulations actually implemented. Mm. So this year of big elections is the most dangerous time imaginable. People have identified the problems, they've written the laws, but the companies are not going to begin to respond until next year. So we are in the absolute worst moment for this.
Mm. And with social media, that is exactly the kind of rhythm that the social media companies developed so fast, so effectively from their own perspective, that the politicians, by the time their process got anywhere near on top of it, it had already gone. Now, listen, here's one which Bex Bitchley, the political situation in Germany, what has happened to such a stable country?
Yeah, go on, tell us about that.
Yep. Have you followed this stuff yesterday?
Go on, tell us.
Well, we're very used to seeing the French out on the streets, but the German farmers have pretty much yesterday, they just blocked virtually every major road in the country.
And this is about?
It's about subsidies, it's about diesel prices, it's about, you know, traditional farming issues. But it's been pretty heavy, and especially as the government had actually responded to some of their concerns and made some concessions ahead of it. I suspect if Franz Beckenbauer hadn't died yesterday, which obviously is a massive, well, it's a big story here as well, but massive news in Germany, this has been like a really, really difficult moment for the police, for the authorities, and it just didn't feel very German. And of course, the AfD are desperately trying to get all over it.
Well, tell us a little bit more about that, because one of the things we didn't cover in as much depth as you would have been able to do is the AfD's success in elections in Bavaria.
Mm.
So give us a sense of what the story's been. I mean, you began talking to us about AfD successes earlier last year, but what's been going on over the last few months with the AfD?
Well, they've won real power in some places, fairly small communities, but mayoral elections and so forth. They're steadily now sort of 20%, in some places 30% in the polls. But the bigger problem, I think, is that the Ampel coalition, the traffic light coalition, they're all struggling in different ways. Has Scholz really been able to sort of deliver some of the campaign promises? Struggling. Are the tensions, the Lindner wing of the coalition actually had a vote over the...
What's this wing?
The third part, the Free right. Democrats. They had a vote about whether to continue with the coalition. Now, it was passed, but there are clearly big divisions there. You read a lot about difficulties between Scholz and Baerbock, who's the leader of the Green part of the coalition and who's the foreign minister. And meanwhile, these protests... So Robert Habeck, who's the vice chancellor, he was on holiday in somewhere up in the north on one of the islands and got a ferry back. Word spread that he was on this ferry, and these farmers, no doubt, perhaps sort of ventilated by some of these hard right forces as well, they turned up to greet the ferry, and the police turned out and they advised the ferry to go elsewhere.
Goodness.
So this is ferry with other people on who said they were absolutely terrified. They couldn't dock because of these protesters there, and they were sort of, basically, they were looking for him.
Yeah. So this is quite fertile ground for the AfD and the far right in Germany, which continues to exploit, presumably, immigration, climate change.
Cost of living. Yeah.
And the German economy not doing great.
Not doing as well as they used to. And then meanwhile, you've got the European elections. You know, we're back to this point that I've said before about François Hollande saying, have we, the Brits, had our peak populism with Brexit and Johnson? And is Europe now sort of getting there? Now, I don't know whether the European elections, whether the far right will do as well as some of their polling suggests.
Coming in June.
Coming later this year, yeah.
And possible when the European elections happen that we end up with a situation where the AfD does well, where the Swedish Democrats do well.
Le Pen's party
does well. Yeah.
Now, it's possible that it goes the other way. But if you see this happening in Germany at the start of a new year, going into that, and then bear in mind, we've just had, sticking on Europe, last night, news that Macron, it was politely put as that the Prime Minister is resigning in due course. He's going to appoint this guy, Gabriel Attal, who's
Talk us through this. What on earth was the Prime Minister of France resigning and a 34-year-old coming in? What is this all about?
Well, I suspect it's all about him trying to give the government a bit of a refresh. I think she's done a pretty amazing job,
right,
considering he hasn't had a parliamentary majority. She's had to get things through the National Assembly. But anyway, Gabriel Attal, he's 34, he's the education minister. He's a very smart, young communicator, background in, I think, communications. He's clearly talking about it's time to refresh. That's the sort of thinking behind it. European parliamentary elections never really felt in the UK that they were as important as they do in other parts of the European Union. But these are a big deal for
although, of course,
Macron and Scholz.
The success of the UKIP Brexit Party in some of those elections was quite important in terms of pushing the Conservative Party and scaring them.
Also the way that Farage used his position in the European Parliament as a platform. We had a question about Farage, actually. Nick Simpson, what's Farage's game in terms of the will he, won't he be involved with reform during the election? Is he trying to win a place in the Tory party, drum up more publicity, or is he genuinely unsure?
I imagine he's trying to spot all the angles and work out what allows him to go to the election with the maximum impact for Nigel Farage.
And what do you think? Do you think his impact is, when you say Nigel Farage, do you think he actually has political beliefs that he wants to put out there, or is it just an old tactical
game?
Presumably
his real dream is to be Prime Minister, and his best route to be Prime Minister is to take over the Conservative Party, not to stay with Reform. But it's a very, very long shot. I mean, he's not an MP. He's not currently going to be allowed to run as a Conservative MP, and it's very unlikely he'd be able to win a Conservative leadership race. So the alternative, I guess, is to try to continue chipping away and build Reform up as a party, but in a two-party system. I don't know how they're going to get the seats.
Or is it just about his own profile now? It's interesting, when we were talking to Guy Verhofstadt on leading, I don't know how many, he mentioned Farage several times, didn't he? He's a big figure politically. Is it maybe just about him? And you know, I hesitate to say I felt sorry for Richard Tice. I wouldn't go that far, but it was fascinating.
Richard Tice is the chair of Reform.
He's the leader of Reform.
And Reform is what was Brexit.
Exactly. Sort of Goldsmith and the Referendum Party. And so he did a sort of New Year's press conference, to which the press went along in fairly large numbers because they were told there were going to be special guests there. And it turned out that the special guest was that woman that I had the rather irate argument on Newsnight. But they all thought it was going to be Farage.
So they were disappointed.
I think it's fair to say they were disappointed. Yeah. And all the coverage was about not what they did say, but who wasn't there.
Right.
So I think he's probably playing a game. He'll love the fact somebody will be saying, oh, Alistair Campbell and Rory Stewart are talking about it. He'll like all that bollocks. But reformers, the Tories must be worried about Reform, I'd have thought, in some of these seats in the North.
It's the question that is asked all the time in every country facing a far-right movement, which is, do you try to ignore them or do you try to poach their voters back by playing some of their tunes? And generally, I mean, it's not 100% true because Boris Johnson was a bit of an exception to this, but generally, if you start playing their tunes, you're doomed because they can always go further right than you can.
Yeah.
And you end up going down.
Okay, Rory, quick break. Back in a minute.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, "Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school?" Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, "I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii." Okay. And I looked at him. I said, "You're done." I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest Is Politics, is launching Stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest Is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Emma Seaver, Horizon was a PFI initiative. Horizon is this system that was used by the post office with this incredible bugs and errors that ended up with people being completely unfairly prosecuted. What are Alistair's reflections on PFI, private finance initiatives? Positive outcomes, limitations, did the nature of PFI contribute to the scandal of what was happening with the post office scandal? Let me just quickly for listeners. PFI is something that the New Labour government went into a great deal, but the Conservatives were doing before. And the idea was that you get the private sector to pay for some of the upfront costs, and then the government pays rent later. So an example would be the private sector builds a spanking new prison, so it doesn't appear on the government's balance sheets, and then the government basically pays them a rent for the next 25 years for using the prison. They do it with hospitals. In the case of Horizon, Fujitsu, which was the parent company of this bidder, said that they would build this entire computer system for free in exchange for getting the revenue every time somebody swipes through their benefits card. So again, very attractive to the government because it's really good for their public balance sheet and debt because it's all theoretically sits with the private sector. And it's all paid for through the current account, not through the capital account. Anyway, over to you on PFIs.
Well, I'd say there were positive outcomes and there are also limitations. I don't think we could have done the scale of public sector investment repair, say in schools and rebuilding of schools and also development of hospitals. I don't think we could have done it without PFI. I think if we'd have just sort of gone in and said, right, the only way we can do this is through raising your taxes. One, would we have won the election with the majority that we got? Unlikely. Would we, if we just decided to do it that way in government, would that not have led to endlessly being accused of betrayal, therefore wouldn't have won the second term, let alone the third term? So I think that PFI was an important part of the public sector.
But where if the government getting money into the system without raising taxes or borrowing? Because basically the private sector is paying for it and then the government pays them back later.
In a sense, you're sharing the risk.
Right.
And I think the limitations, I mean, this came out when we're talking about the post office, you're dependent in a way on the same standards being applied as you would to a public sector operation, and that is not always going to be the case.
One of the things that I noticed when we were dealing with these things in the Ministry of Justice is that unlike a normal commercial contract, the government is really over a barrel. So when the government decided, this was a Chris Grayling decision, who was this sort of not much lamented Conservative cabinet minister who decided to privatize probation and privatize maintenance of prisons.
Well, that was quite a rare example of where they went into it and then literally reversed it.
Well, exactly. So when I was in, we reversed it. David Gawke and I reversed these things and renationalized.
What were the difficulties in doing that with the contracts that you'd entered into?
It was unbelievably difficult and unbelievably costly. But the problem with this type of privatization is that if the private sector company doesn't deliver, so it doesn't supervise people on probation, so the criminals on the loose who aren't being met, or it doesn't maintain prisons, in the end, it drops back on the government anyway. You can't just say, oh, well, you know, sort it out. You know, you promised to do this. And what we found is the private sector would come in and it would massively underbid. So we were spending, I think it was £185 million a year maintaining prisons. Private sector company comes in and it, you know, it's one of these companies that emerged to do this kind of stuff. And they said they would do it for, I think, £45 million. Sure enough, couple of years later, none of the prisons are being maintained, right? Really rubbish, stale windows are broken, there's filth everywhere. And the company basically says, well, what do you expect? I mean, you know, you were doing it for 170 million, and we're doing it for 45 million, so obviously it's rubbish. And we then try to insist on our terms, at which point the company simply declared bankruptcy and walked away. And it was the same with the probation system. And it then turns out that although they've got, in the case of probation, massive multinational parent companies, these American multinationals have written the law in such a way that their British subsidiary, they're not really responsible for. So we ended up covering tens of millions of pounds worth of debt, having to bring the whole thing back in house. And then, of course, we have to spend the 180 million on maintenance instead of 40 million. So we now got another 140 million pounds a year that we have to spend for. Whole thing goes wrong. So I think the problem with a lot of these PFIs, and it's true with hospitals and schools, is that in the end, the government has to carry the can because we've still got to run the schools, we've got to run the hospitals. So there's no risk for these companies. They can get the contracts and underbidding, they can underperform. And in the end, if it all goes wrong, we have to take it over. It's the same with Birmingham Prison.
I think the other thing on procurement is particularly, because I don't think a Labour government, if Keir Starmer becomes Prime Minister, I emphasised, Stephen Munro, are you listening? He's going to be in a similar position to the one that we were. So unless you're sort of saying, well, we're going to cut the private sector out of this, some of these public sector projects, there's a lot of stuff that Labour are going to have to do that they won't be able to do. So I think the if you look at the one of the lessons from the post office, and I think this goes across our government and it goes across your government, there is a sort of technology and it still has this capacity to kind of to make people feel that they can't challenge it. And that does give these companies an awful lot of power. And the other thing is, you're talking sometimes within the procurement process of, if you have a negotiating table, you've got a middle-ranking civil servant who earns, I don't know what, but way short, well south of six figures, up against people who are bigger in number, bigger in experience, and who are better at doing some of the sort of dodgy stuff that maybe you have to do when you're trying to get big contracts out of the public sector. Now, in other countries, that leads to all sorts of wide-scale corruption to get deals over the line. And I worry sometimes there's been a little bit too much of that in our country as well of late. But the one thing it does do is give these big private sector companies a massive advantage. Now, maybe that means if we are going to continue with this sort of approach to big infrastructure projects, you've got to start thinking about, well, do we need to bring in people? And I'm sorry, but we're going to have to pay them more than a cabinet minister gets. Because if we don't, we're going to continue to be reliant on people who are being outplayed the whole time.
And I mean, this whole story of procurement is amazing. But the other way in which government really screws it up again and again is it's always changing the spec. So it will sign a contract to do one thing. And then in the case of the post office scandal, I think it changed 300 times the spec of what was supposed to be delivered, which gives a huge opportunity to Fujitsu to say, well, you know, that wasn't in the contract. We've got to do something new. It's the same with, I was talking to somebody who's a great listener to our program who had worked in MOD procurement on a ship contract where the government came along, decided it was going to make a ship that had been used in the Falklands, you know, 30 foot longer, and ended up paying hundreds of millions of pounds because everything it did involved changing its mind. And every time it changed its mind, the company could come back and say, oh, well, you want a steel hull instead of an aluminium hull, and you want to put 52 tanks on instead of 38 tanks, which is one of the reasons why all these things massively overrun. Because every senior civil servant's changed too much, change every couple of years, comes with another set of bright ideas. The world's moved on. Oh, well, if we're building this tank, we might as well add another set of bells and whistles because, you know, as new technologies come in. It is horrifying how we get screwed over again and again.
Morty Barclay, on one of the 2023 Roundup episodes, Rory mentioned that he found the movie Barbie disturbing. Could he expand upon why he found it to be so? I thought that at the time. I remember you saying that, and I thought, should I probe on that? But then I thought, we're not, the rest is entertainment.
Did you love the movie?
I didn't, and I didn't hate it, but I don't know if I didn't think it was great. I was glad Oppenheimer won the Golden Globes.
Yeah. I thought it was a bit weird, Barbie, because I thought it was trying to do a kind of cute feminist narrative by undermining the old chauvinistic assumptions of Barbie. But in the end, I sort of thought, paradoxically, it kind of played into the same kind of narratives. It was just a different kind of cliche.
Yeah.
I didn't think it was very interesting.
But that sounds like you were bored rather than disturbed.
Yeah, maybe I find it getting bored disturbing. Vicky Bamforth, can you talk about what's happening in Burma, please? Ethnic and democratic opposition forces defeat more of the junta's army, and a transfer of power seems possible. How can the UK government support a peaceful transfer of power and avoid a breakdown to ethnic armed states? So, very good question. Shoshana, my wife, is in Myanmar, is in Burma as we speak, right in the heart of all this, just been visiting an IDP camp. It is an astonishing story. I mean, we've talked about Sudan, we've talked about Yemen, but Myanmar has been an ongoing conflict ever since basically the military intervened, overruled the election, put Aung San Suu Kyi, the lady, under house arrest on a trumped-up charge around the use of a walkie-talkie. And since then, there has been an explosion of violence, which has included professionals in the Burmese heartland demonstrating against the military, but most dramatically of all the minority peoples around the fringes of Burma, Karen, Chin, Kachin, Shan, finding themselves in a massive insurgency against the Burmese army. And it's something that could be sorted, not by the UK, but it's something that could be helped if the US and China really got together on this. But the US and China don't seem to want to play ball.
Why do you think it is? I mean, Myanmar is a country which, in particular when she was in opposition and as a sort of freedom fighter, as it were, was right up there as one of the countries that we talked about, the media covered, that politics followed. It seems to have sort of dropped right off the map.
Well, I think because of the massive disappointment, because this was a thing that had been run by a military regime from the 1960s. And then this extraordinary woman, an incredibly beautiful, charismatic, dedicated, who'd been under house arrest for 20 years, leads a democratic movement, brings democracy finally to this country with so much potential natural resources. And then, of course, the terrible compromises around what happened to the Rohingya.
And do you think she could have compromised in a different way? Or do you think she had no choice?
Well, so this is really interesting. So at the time, of course, we all thought this is absolutely horrifying. Why is this woman not condemning what the Burmese military is doing to the Rohingya? Her defense at the time, apart from the fact I think she's also a Burmese nationalist who didn't have much sympathy for the Rohingya, was if I challenge the military on this, I'll be toppled in the coup d'etat. Mm. She then was toppled in a coup d'etat.
Anyway.
And now we are back to the horror. So I think people, it's sadly become one of these things. Bangladesh is another example. DRC in a more dramatic way is another example. Many of these coup d'etats in Africa that we've seen over the last year, where I just think we're becoming inured to the collapse of democracies. We no longer have the optimism or the confidence to...
Just on the Rohingya, we should point out, because we're pretty, I think it's fair to say, fairly negative about Sheikh Hasina, the continuing Prime Minister of Bangladesh. She did get a lot of praise at the time for the fact that Bangladesh took in an awful lot of the Rohingya. Should we go a bit lighter?
Yeah, go on then.
Pete B, could you settle the appropriate number of books by the bed debate? My current value of 15 is, I'm told by the bed's other occupant, 14 too many. Where do you stand on?
Well, 15, I mean, that's quite an unstable pile, isn't it? I guess that's
about
3-4 feet.
Yeah. We got this question last night and I counted. I know it's just past Christmas, but Fiona had 12.
12, you see, that's impressive.
I had one.
Ooh.
I normally have a lot more, but what I've done, I've got a new system.
Yeah.
New year, new system. I've put my bedside pile on a shelf close to the bed.
That's very good.
So they're not actually on the floor. It won't last more than a couple of weeks, but...
Well, so my answer, of course, is a Kindle. And I'm sitting here with a Kindle. And I have discovered that I have got 1,961 books on my Kindle.
How many of them have you read already?
Oh, no, sorry. I'm sorry. I must have more than that. My goodness. It claims to have 2,320.
Right.
And on this Kindle, I've only read 476 of them.
Do you buy books that you never read? I know you read a lot, but do you buy a lot of books and then don't read them?
I tend to read the first few chapters. So, for example, this book on politics and governance in Bangladesh, after 2-3 chapters, I thought, I'm not so sure.
What about the post office book? Did you go the whole way?
Post office book, I will get the whole way through. I'm actually only 3/4 of the way through, but I think it's brilliant. Yeah. Really, really strongly recommended.
Okay.
Final question for me. SJ Tots, have you got a favourite fictional fantasy book or film or television series that you would recommend? Now, I don't know, you maybe don't like fantasy stuff.
I don't know. Is that a terrible thing to admit?
No. I mean, I think it's fair enough. You didn't like Game of Thrones or any of that kind of stuff.
No,
I didn't like it.
No.
My big recommendation, which is more sci-fi, which I just think is just fantastic, particularly on Audible, is something called Project Hail Mary, which is the most wonderful imagined account of a man going off on a mission into space to save the world. And it's actually taught my children more about science than anything you can possibly imagine. because it's full of really good contemporary science and a really engaging story about an alien encounter. So Project Hail Mary.
I'm probably going to be revealing something terrible about myself right now, but I didn't really enjoy cartoons as a child.
Ah, you didn't? I never.
I quite liked Tom and Jerry, but I quite liked the Flintstones, but I didn't get into them.
I didn't do cartoons either.
But you do science fiction.
But I do science fiction. But I'm actually worrying a little bit because, like you, I've been thinking about writing a book for children. But I realized that as a child, I didn't actually read that many children's books. I began reading adult books quite early. And I'm reading, if you're looking for a book to read to children, which is an adult book, but really works, I think, for a six-year-old, The Rise and Fall of the Dinosaurs by Steve Brusatti. It's amazing. He's a professor at a Scottish university, but he writes so well that I think anyone from 80 to 6 would enjoy it.
Somebody sent in a message just before Christmas saying, will you please stop giving book recommendations? We can't possibly read all these books. And then somebody today is saying, can we please have more book recommendations? So let's go with more.
Zachariah Slater, what are your best restaurants in London? You got a recommendation for restaurants in London?
Oh, God, I got into real grief recently.
Oh, all right.
I did an interview with a London newspaper or magazine or something, I can't remember what it was, and they said, favourite restaurants?
Yeah.
And I said, we're not very well blessed for good restaurants.
Oh, Lord.
In our area.
No.
But then went on to name a couple. But every other restaurant I've been to since.
Went mad.
So I'm going to say Rosella's.
Yes.
In Kentish Town. I'm going to say Mimo La Bufala.
Yes.
In South End Green. And I'm going to say Ravel's. They're all very near where I live.
And what are they? Mostly Italian food, right?
Rosella's, yes.
Yeah.
Ravel's is a very nice kind of old-fashioned restaurant.
Sort of white tablecloths.
Yeah. And sort of, you know, quite a varied menu.
Brushing the bread off your white tablecloth.
I always have duck en croûte and red cabbage.
Duck en croûte?
Always. I never have anything else there. And then Mimo La Bufala is run by this wonderful, colourful, very charismatic and funny Italian. He's not been very well recently, but he was a motor racer called Mimo, who had a terrible accent and then went into the restaurant trade.
Well, I've got a couple of recommendations. So best dim sum in London, you want sort of dumplings.
Yeah, that's kind of science fiction for me.
Yeah, you'd go either to Joy King Lau in Leicester Square or Jia in South Kensington. But little niche, if you want a fancier meal, I mean, a really fancy, lovely meal in a very small restaurant, Kitty Fisher's in Shepherd's Market is really amazing treat, but it's only got, I think, about 7 tables.
Well, I'm sure that next week they'll have lots of restless politics listeners.
Good.
Very good. See you next week.
See you next week. Bye-bye.